Today in Studio 360, the director Julie Taymor, who's walked away from her Broadway Spider-Man nightmare.
It is surreal. It's a good one to have in your past.
And into a gorgeous dream, the Midsummer Night's version, written by Shakespeare, staged by Taymor.
The idea with the children was that they would play the forest, the trees, the animals. They would be your nightmares. They would be the fairy.
Plus, Adam Driver, best known for playing Lena Dunham's erratic boyfriend on Girls. It was a near-death experience in the Marine Corps that turned him into an actor.
Suddenly you hear a big explosion, we look up and there's white phosphorus coming down on us. And the two things that I wanted to do is I wanted to smoke and be an actor.
Driver has been stealing scenes ever since. He even steals a song from Justin Timberlake in the new Coen Brothers movie Inside Llewyn Davis.
1 second, please. Please, Mr.
Kennedy. That and more is ahead in this hour of Studio 360, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
The glory of God is all around us, Hannah!
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Trees, frogs, birdie birds.
I hate this!
The actor Adam Driver graduated from Juilliard's theater program just 4 years ago, but he's already got a resume any actor would kill for. He's worked for Clint Eastwood, Steven Spielberg, and most recently, the Coen brothers on Inside Llewyn Davis. And he booked all those gigs before his groundbreaking TV show Girls even went on the air. I'll talk with him later this hour. But first, 2013 has been a year of opposites attracting. Take a look at the unexpected collaborations in pop music. The rapper LL Cool J and the country singer Brad Paisley. Daft Punk and Pharrell. Jay-Z and Coldplay. Then there's Alfonso Cuarón, the director of exquisite small movies like Children of Men and Y Tu Mamá También, made a blockbuster state-of-the-art sci-fi thriller, Gravity. While Joss Whedon, who's directed The Avengers and Thor, released a little black-and-white Shakespeare movie he filmed at his house. The wind seemed to blow every which way in 2013, so what is the cultural weather forecast for 2014? Joining me to chart that are Paul Rudnick and Mary Elizabeth Williams. Paul is a playwright, screenwriter, novelist, and New Yorker humorist, and Mary Elizabeth is a cultural critic for Salon. Paul, Mary Elizabeth, welcome back to Studio 360.
Hi.
Thank you.
So, 2013, we must say it, was the year of Miley Cyrus. She twerked and tweeted, and she was everywhere. And they were constantly playing this song pretty much everywhere I went. So, 2014, do we get a break or is this just the beginning of Miley? Mary Elizabeth?
I don't need a break from Miley. I'm fine with Miley.
Yeah?
I'm team Miley, and I think her world domination is only just begun. But now, you know, over the past few days, we've had the re-emergence of Beyoncé, and I think it's going to get a lot more interesting in terms of pop music and women dominating it. So I'm excited.
But isn't Beyoncé just in a whole other category of we should take her seriously versus Miley Cyrus?
Well, you're saying we shouldn't take Miley seriously. And I think just because a young woman wants to twerk now and then does not mean she doesn't have something to say. I think she's an incredibly canny performer.
That's what we've been saying about all successful women since Madonna. They're canny. Paul, Miley Cyrus?
Well, I see. I love Miley because I think at heart she is still a Disney girl. Really, even when she rubs up against one of her dancers, it's sort of like Jasmine rubbing up against Mulan. You know, that her idea of a revolutionary gesture is kind of a tiny tattoo and bangs.
You know, she continues to be very outspoken about things like LGBT rights and about women's issues. And, you know, I don't necessarily think she's at Beyoncé brilliance, but I do think she's here to stay. And I think she's going to keep growing as a performer.
I think Beyoncé has become the Meryl Streep of music. You know, it's so interesting how quickly she's become the older classical figure and that she's been so smart this week, but she really now feels kind of stately.
Yes.
You know, somewhere between
First
Meryl
lady-ish.
And Oprah.
Yeah,
yes,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just broke an iTunes record for sales. You know, she's through the roof. She's untouchable.
And she did not release this record in a hard version, no CD at all. So right. that which shows that she's thinking about the future. Are CDs over? CDs already, to me, look like antiques when I am sent them.
My kids have no idea what a CD is.
Really?
So pretty much,
but
no,
they use a rotary phone.
Oh, yeah, because that's cool.
I don't know if it's nostalgia, but in terms of great old things becoming more current, there is so much Shakespeare going on the stage. Too much? Well, for instance, this year we had Alan Cumming doing Macbeth.
It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
Then we had Ethan Hawke doing Macbeth.
It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
Then in the spring we have Kenneth Branagh doing
Orlando
Macbeth.
Bloom.
Orlando Bloom doing Romeo
Mark
and Juliet.
Mark Rylance. Do not forget Mark Rylance.
And Julie Taymor made her comeback doing this beautiful Midsummer Night's Dream. Why?
Because you don't have to pay the writer.
Says the playwright. He's got it.
Excuse me, no lawyers.
That's it, because it's just great storytelling. And the fact that you can still do something new and interesting and moving with Shakespeare, of course it's never going to go away.
No,
also, I think when you're involved with star casting and short runs at very high ticket prices, it's easier sometimes to engage a star if you say this is a proven commodity. You're going to get to play Romeo for 12 weeks, you know, on Broadway. So it's
not only you're a Broadway actor, but you are a Shakespearean
yes,
actor.
Yes, it's star bait. Yeah.
But my favorite star bait is all about Hedwig and the Angry Inch, Neil Patrick Harris. You know, I'm looking forward to seeing Kenneth Branagh do Macbeth, but I am really, really looking forward to Neil Patrick Harris in a wig.
So Breaking Bad, of which I was, like everyone I know, a huge fan, there is no more Breaking Bad. What will those millions of people obsessively watch and discuss?
We have Game of Thrones coming up again, reigniting. We have another season of Orange is the New Black, which everybody is obsessing about. We have a brand new Doctor on Doctor Who that I'm just losing my mind over. We have a new Sherlock.
All those sound good, but I'm sorry. They're not Breaking Bad level.
Bad Men finale? You're not excited about that? Oh, you're so wrong. You're so wrong.
No doubt. 2013 was also the year of the bad girl in lots of ways, criminally bad girls, like in the movies Spring Breakers, The Bling Ring, Violet and Daisy. What is that about? And is it just a momentary phase and now there's going to be a good girl backlash?
I am really looking forward to seeing what I hope is a continuation of the trend of really strong female heroes, you know, like we saw with Gravity. My daughters are thrilled about Divergent, which is coming in the summer with Shailene Woodley. They're out of their minds for The Fault in Our Stars. Also Shailene Woodley, she's, I think, poised to be the next Jennifer Lawrence.
And then there's Jennifer Lawrence.
We have the
continuing
final,
to do a more amazing thing.
Right, who's just incredible and who's going to do the final chapter in the Hunger Games series, or the final two. You know, bad girls never go away entirely, but I'm really thrilled when I see how many strong, beautiful roles for women, and particularly young women, there are out there now.
Well, and also the most popular recording artist around right now is Taylor Swift.
Once upon a time, a few mistakes ago, I was in your sights. You got me alone. You found me. You found me. You found me.
Who is a very wonderfully good girl.
Which is one of the reasons she generates so much hate, I guess, on the internet.
Oh, absolutely. Well, also, that degree of success at that young an age and with that degree of control is always going to inspire massive jealousy.
Paul, Mary Elizabeth, thank you very much for being here again today. Happy New Year, and we'll bring you back and check on how all of these musings and predictions worked out.
Happy New Year.
Yes, indeed.
Maybe next year I'll be good. Maybe next year I'll be better. Maybe next year I'll be good.
And speaking of 2013, all year long, we've been following four ambitious listeners. Back in January, they had creative New Year's resolutions, and we had this radio show to keep them publicly accountable, including Michael Relland in Phoenix. He plays the cello, but he'd never done it publicly. So his goal for 2013?
A big recital, me and the cello on the stage, in front of friends and family in the community.
Well, Michael practiced all year, and on the 1st of December, he found a pianist and went public.
Most New Year's resolutions fail. And I think New Year's resolutions often are negative. I've got to do something better, something part of me that's lacking. This is very positive. I think they'll even be cake afterwards. So if we get through it, all is well.
Congratulations, Michael. Mission accomplished.
Yes, thank you.
You gave us a preview back in March, and from what I hear of the recital that you just did a few weeks ago, you improved tremendously in these 9 months.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it does seem to be more about the diligence of it, you know, really kind of changing my day and making practice truly a part of it. So really, when it was all said and done, I think the recital itself, it really just passed through my brain, and now it's just a matter of how can I continue to get better.
Having done this for a year and having that be the, not the end point, but the way station in the journey, that it's going to change the way you live, play the cello, how is it going to change your life?
It really humbles me to hear these masterpieces and me trying to attack them. I think in future I'm going to play easier things and take lessons and accept guidance and do more things that are reaching out in slow, sustained ways rather than what I've done before, which is just, okay, I'm going to play next week and I'll just put this thing together real quick. So the quality of my playing, I'm very sensitive about it. I mean, humbling is the positive word for it. Really, I listen to the recording of myself, and I'm like, oh, man, I don't sound good at all.
It's ironic that you, a music educator, are saying, you know what I learned? I've got to listen to guidance and take lessons.
Yes, this is true. But, you know, I think the way I phrase it is I want to do the recital that I never did when I was younger. And when I was younger, everyone around me was very intensely studious on their instrument. And I was just interested in so many different things. And lo and behold, here I am, age 43, and I need to actually apply myself to be at a level that I think I want to be at and try not to be in a negative space about it. And that's hard.
Right. And was it, I mean, certainly standing up there and beginning to play must have been scary. Was it scary all the way through?
Well, that was the positive part. I mean, listening to myself, as I said, was challenging. But the playing of it was the exciting part because my hands were doing things they didn't know how to do 8 months ago.
Wow.
And the experience of it was really like what you hear from professionals, that the playing of it just happens on its own because you've trained your muscles to do that. And you can kind of sit back and enjoy that a bit.
That's fantastic. I want to wish you congratulations again, Michael, and thanks for doing this with us.
Thanks, Kurt.
You can hear Michael's recital performance of Beethoven's Sonata No. 4 on our website. So, we were 4 for 4. Everyone who signed on with us finished their projects in 2013. Therefore, let's do it again. We want to hear about your creative New Year's resolution for next year. Let us know what you plan on doing or making at studio360.org or call and leave us a message at 646-580-0360. Again, that's 646-580-0360. Coming up next, the director Julie Taymor. She spent the last 15 years working with Simba, Spider-Man, U2, but now she's returned to her first love, Shakespeare.
It's this balance between the magical, the dreamlike, and the concrete. And I think that Shakespeare's written a play like that, where you're constantly moving from this surreal, beautiful, into funky, fundamental, crude, real world.
Julie Taymor is next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Back in 2002, Julie Taymor was the new queen of Broadway, a MacArthur genius and the creator of The Lion King, which became the most lucrative Broadway musical of all time. More recently, she got a lot of attention for being in maybe the most notorious Broadway musical in modern history, Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. The budget was enormous, unprecedented. The opening was delayed and delayed again. Actors were injured multiple times. Critics hated it. And disagreements among the creators and producers ended with Taymor getting fired just before opening night. So what do you do when you've suffered such a public flop? You get back to basics. Julie Taymor has returned to Shakespeare in a stunning way. Her version of Midsummer Night's Dream, the most wonderful I've ever seen, begins with a simple bed in the center of the stage. An odd little person in a bowler hat enters and falls asleep on the bed. It's the fairy Puck.
And at the moment that she lies down on the bed, four workmen come out with ropes and hooks, and they hoist up this silk. And what happens is the sheet just pulls out, and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger till it fills the full space, a giant rectangle, and it rises up in the air. And magically, this figure who's been sleeping on it rises up with it, leaving the bed on the ground till it goes up into the sky. And as soon as it hits the highest point, clouds appear in a blue sky. Their projections on this sheet, and as the clouds move along, it reveals the words, A Midsummer Night's Dream. The idea for the bed, the sheet, was if you take a theater piece and you try and reduce it to its ideograph, to its essence, what could that be? And the word shadows kept coming up all throughout the play. And how do you create shadows? The most simple way is on a blank white piece of paper or a white sheet with a light and your hand or shadows. Everything in the show, almost everything is hand done. Even the simple bit of flying is counterbalanced. So it's, which makes it a lot easier
and
to do.
And you did flying.
We did do flying. Very little. Very little for obvious reasons.
But you got back on that saddle. I was happy to see some flying. And it was beautifully done by this same Puck.
Oh, yeah. No, she's an unbelievable actress and so physically not only fit, but also capable, and she loved doing it. We went as far as she wanted to go.
And you mentioned, you used the word ideograph.
Yes.
Your attempt to distill the idea of a piece, a story, to a visual image?
If you were to take The Lion King and you were going to take one simple image that represents that show, it would be the circle. So Richard Hudson, the set designer, and I worked on how Pride Rock wouldn't be the kind that was in the animated film, but would be actually circular as it came out of the floor and rose up. And then you have Mufasa's mask. Then you have the sun rise, the circle. Then you have the wheels of the gazelle wheel. So in the case of Midsummer, of course, it is that bedsheet. It's a simple, physical, concrete thing that can transform. And I think it's emblematic of the entire piece that Shakespeare wrote. You know, where is reality? What is real? Where are we in our interior landscapes? How do we move from the physical world to the dream world? So as a director is looking for that, not just for the set design, but it is the symbol of the whole piece, and it gives you boundaries. It gives you limitations. And it is scary because you don't know how these kinds of elements, it's not always controllable.
Right.
So you have to have a little bit of that. That is the circus part where you feel a little bit of the danger in a good way, the things where it doesn't always do it exactly the same way every night.
Which is why it's live theater.
That's right. And that's what people love about it.
So the show, as I hope we've conveyed, is stunning looking. The score is also very lush. I particularly love the lullaby that Titania's fairies sing. We're going to play a little bit of that now.
The idea with the children was that they would play all the elements, that they would be the forest, the trees, the animals. They would be your nightmares. They would be the fairies. You know, they would play that. And they even play the children. They finally become even themselves. But the notion is that there is a kind of dark, dangerous wildness to our inner instincts.
Right.
They're also raw.
The play ties up most all of the loose ends except this one, Demetrius, who's one of the lovers who has this potion that has made him fall in love with the right person. He doesn't get the antidote, so we don't know, is he really in love with Helena?
I've actually gone through two different thoughts about that. At first I thought, wow, how cynical of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Then I thought, no, I think that what this is that sometimes drugs or alcohol or other kinds of stimulants open yourself up.
Convince you of what is true.
Not even convince you. Open your eyes and your mind. That's, I mean, during the whole 60s, the whole LSD, which I never took, but many people.
Really?
No.
I would have thought.
I know, but I didn't. But I had my brother and sister and other people I knew did enough. But at any rate, I think more what Shakespeare is saying, that he was a very uptight, controlled person, and that it took this experience of him to actually see her for who she was. And I prefer that take on it. I prefer the idea that he didn't need the antidote.
It's not a spell.
Yeah.
So you're not a cynic. You're a
romantic. No, I'm not a cynic. I am a romantic, even though I love really dark material.
So for the first couple of decades of your career, you made this big name for yourself as an incredibly innovative, very off-Broadway theatrical artist. And you became a MacArthur genius in 1991. And then you get this call from Disney, who say, we'd like you to turn The Lion King into this huge Broadway musical. At that point in your career, coming from the sort of opposite end of the showbiz spectrum, there must have been some hesitation, no?
There was. But we actually were inspired by the same source material, the fables, the fairy tales, the international fairy tales, and that historically Disney did not shy away from dark things. Even in The Lion King, Mufasa, the father, dies.
Yeah.
Bambi's mother
Snow White
dies.
Scared me more than any other movie
Absolutely.
I saw as a child.
I mean, Grimm's fairy tales, any of these children's stories are terrifying for a reason.
But, okay, you decide this can work, but then must this big corporate L.A. show business thing, can I trust them?
Well, they said, we want you to do what you do. That's why we're hiring you. We're not hiring you to do Disney style. I said, look, I have a very different aesthetic. And they said, no, we want you to do what you do. And I literally was working with terrific individuals. I wasn't working with a corporation.
Right. So having had this extraordinarily positive experience with your artistic collaborators, your business collaborators, did that sort of trick you into not doing enough due diligence on Spider-Man?
No. What happened with Spider-Man, and we won't dwell on it.
Talk a little bit.
Well, we had a wonderful producer who died.
Yeah.
And he was
before
Tony Adams
opened.
Way before, like 7 years before. And then his partner, who was a lawyer, took over. And then we had the financial crisis and all the money was gone. Meanwhile, I was doing two feature films and an opera, I think, during that 8 years. And I had a great time working on it, a fabulous time. But the third set of producers weren't there from the beginning. So what I said about The Lion King is really the point. You have to be on the same page. Are we all after the same thing? And I think what happened with Spider-Man is by the time we got there, there are two things that happened, or three. One is Bono and Edge weren't available because the timing was we'd run out of there was a deadline by Marvel on when we had to open, and because it had been postponed for various reasons, raising the money or remaking the sets because they'd been trashed, they were on a tour. You can't do a new musical without your composer and lyricist there. Impossible. Secondly, a big set design that was the coup de théâtre didn't work, and we didn't know it. So we didn't have an ending, and we kept struggling. And the third is that the book, though we all had been behind the book, I'm not sure the last set of producers cared. I think that they were investors who became producers and really just wanted to hit whatever that might be.
We got you too. We got Julie Taymor.
Right.
We spent a lot of money. Let's make it a hit.
But as the co-writer, the book never got on stage. We never finished it. The critics came, preempted the reviews because they were angry that we weren't opening. I don't know, all the anger and hostility.
That there were so many months of previews.
But you know, we had the same amount of previews we had as Lion King. But when we went out of town with Lion King and you then allow the show to develop out of town and we made our mistakes, then you come in, it ends up being the same. And really, we were trying to break ground on the kind of theater we are doing. Cirque du Soleil in Vegas, they have soft openings for a year because you don't know when you're inventing new flying things. You can't push it fast. You know, you can't do it.
Right.
So why be upset? It took us 5 hours to do a 30-second change because everything was computerized. That's where I love Midsummer, because it was all, it's all old-fashioned, hand-run. If we need to say, oh, no, make her go higher, make her go lower, or make this sheet go up or down, it's by humans.
And you had the whatever, the luck, good or bad, of being this big show opening just as social media was becoming a thing.
Yeah, that was way before you're ready to have people talking about it.
Thousands of volunteer critics?
That's right. And, you know, people say, oh, get used to it, kid. You know, too bad. That's the way life is. And that's true. But it also is true that you will not be able to create as groundbreaking or inventive or dangerous. And I don't mean dangerous and that people get hurt. What I mean is trying to do things that have never been done before. If you're going to have people criticizing you before you say you're ready. Nobody has to buy tickets if it's in previews. They don't have to. A lot of people like to see things before they're finished. And if we postpone, then you get your money back if you don't want to. So there's no reason to come down hard on that. You should let the process happen.
Right.
The idea of this opening date is should be up to the people who are creating.
Right. Was it – how long did it take you to say, okay, fine, brush off the dust. Now I'm going to do this other stuff.
Well, I luckily have a great friend in Jeffrey Horowitz, the producer, who did attend opening night of Spider-Man with me. And he had already asked me if I would open his new theater with a production.
At which this Midsummer Night's Dream is
playing. That's right. Yeah. And I had been offered other things. I was going to be part of the Shakespeare Year of Shakespeare in London last year. Actually, I was going to do Macbeth, which would have been, you know, too perfect, actually. A great play about treachery. But I decided I didn't need to live in that.
As opposed to this dreamy, sexy, funny, happy play.
And I've been working. I have two screenplays I'm working on and very close to having the financing for. And now I have actually two television series that I'm working on. And
so you were doing things and it took your mind off the craziness.
Yeah. To a degree. I mean, you know, I got offered to do a book and I just declined because I just didn't feel that was the thing to do at the time.
Good move.
Mm-hmm.
You have done films. You are working on more films and television series. Do you get ever as much gratification from a film, from making a film, as you do from your most gratifying theater work?
Yes,
yeah?
Actually. It's not – you know, we all love to be an opening night of your own theater piece, if it's a good opening night,
yeah.
That is, you know, because it is wonderful to be there with the audience, and it's live. There is no comparison
right.
to live theater and film that way, although premieres are pretty exciting.
I guess it's like pornography versus sex, right?
I think so, yeah. It's a little distance, right?
Yeah.
So, but if you create a film like Frida, for instance, which wasn't my project, I was work for hire. But it became my baby as I got involved in it and really worked on it with Salma.
Salma Hayek played Frida Kahlo.
Yeah, Frida Kahlo. With Frida, it was interesting. In America, they go, oh, this is just a dark. Why is the film so colorful? Why has it got all this? Because that's how Frida survived.
Right.
That is Mexican as well, the color there. But it was really the bows, the ribbons, the color in her paintings. It was the way that she did it. How she enjoyed her life through the darkness is the main point of that film. That's why I didn't dwell on the politics or on the morose. There are the dark moments, but it's also got that incredible absolute thirst and love to make whatever you have happen. And people go, why would you do Titus? Because look at Titus. It is the greatest dissertation on violence ever written. We need to tell those stories and understand. In fact, I wrote down in your 360, what have you liked lately? And I'm just finishing Breaking Bad. I have two more. I'm going to finish it today. Titus in a contemporary setting. You know, the protagonist is a good man. And how does a good man turn into this monster? And that's why I think Titus is such a great play. And it was so disturbing for hundreds of years for people because it tells you about how anybody can actually go to that dark place.
Well, keep making work. I want to keep saying. Julie
Taymor,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Julie Taymor's production of A Midsummer Night's Dream is up through January in New York City. You can see some pictures of the show at studio360.org. Julie Taymor and I also talk some more about her time directing the unfortunate Spider-Man musical. You can hear our whole conversation at our website.
Star stars shining right above you. Night breezes seem to whisper, I love you. Birds singing in the sycamore tree. Dream a little dream of me. Say nighty-night and kiss me. Just hold me tight and tell me you miss me. While I'm alone and blue as can be. Dream a little dream of me.
Still ahead. If you're in your 20s and about to work with some of the most successful film directors on Earth, you'll be relieved to know that at least some of them are the opposite of megalomaniac.
They've done all their work, but they still come on the day and are very open to being wrong, which I think is unique and rare.
Adam Driver talks about working with the Coen brothers next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Adam Driver is kind of like a Marlon Brando for millennials. Highly masculine, but angsty, with a vulnerable side. And like Brando, he is stealing scenes like crazy, most often in the TV show Girls.
Do you want to watch Bagger Vance?
I can't. Okay, I'm working the door.
But do you want to watch Bagger Vance extras?
No, like Elijah's being a fascist dictator. I really gotta go. I'll see you later.
What, do you want to make balloon faces?
No, like, Elijah's being crazy. I have to go back to the party.
Driver also steals the most entertaining scene in the new Coen Brothers movie, Inside Llewyn Davis.
1 second, please. Please, Mr. Kennedy.
The film's about a Greenwich Village folk singer in the early 1960s. And that scene involves Driver, Justin Timberlake, and the movie's main character. They're recording a fictional novelty song called Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Powder.
With a healthy libido. Space.
Driver is the goofy baritone, riffing on the lyric. There you are, becoming a musical star. That must have been fun.
Yeah, fun is a word to describe. It was very fun and pretty surreal. Justin Timberlake, Oscar, T-Bone Burnett, all the people that were kind of a revolving cast in and out when we were doing the pre-records for it, and then on the day, just people who were there. I had no idea what I was doing there.
But the odor space and all the little noises, were did you work those out with T-Bone Burnett, or was that just you doing it?
That was all them.
That was written?
Yeah. They happened organically. I can't remember specifically where it came from. I just remember showing up for the pre-records and them kind of figuring it out. And the only good sense I had was to not get involved and kind of just listen and pay attention as much as possible. I think that doing that once was the most petrifying thing I think I've ever done.
Really?
I feel like all the actors were kind of losing their minds with nerves, and all the musicians were kind of just cool as cucumbers.
Working for the Coen brothers, was that intimidating?
Their body of work and the way they work is very intimidating, but them as people is kind of how you kind of hope for them to be, like very approachable and smart and... I feel like I've got the good fortune of working with a lot of people who just work different ways, and for them they are very, you know, specific down to the letter of, you know, it's they are, not their kind of world, which is great. You know,
they like know what they want. They know how it should sound and look and all that.
Yeah, but there's still immense freedom in that, I think. They've done all their work, but they still come on the day and are very open to being wrong, which I think is unique and rare and says something about who they are as people.
That's interesting, since I always think of movie directors as being the ultimate commanders in chief.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's like a big thing that I took away from that. You know, no matter where you are at your career, the things that you've accomplished, never knowing is kind of an interesting place to start. And they definitely embody that.
You graduated from Juilliard only 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And since then, you have become a co-star of the hottest new show on television and worked with the Coens and Steven Spielberg and Clint Eastwood and Tony Kushner. Does the success you've had feel astounding?
Yeah, I don't know how to process it or have had time to think about a good way to articulate it to myself of what is the things I've got to do.
Does it feel all good, or does it like worry you or discombobulate you?
I mean, like working with Tony Kushner and Steven Spielberg and yeah, that's good. I mean,
yeah, I'd say so.
It's not bad. It's not bad, but it's definitely spoiled me for things moving forward. It's just the people I got to work with. I'm like, oh, well, this is the way that this is the way that it should be. You know, like I'll just work with these really good directors from now on. But I don't know how realistic that
yeah.
is.
You play the main male character on Girls, who is also named Adam. I want to play a clip from early on in the show, which I understand you may not have ever heard since you don't watch the show.
Yeah, I don't.
In which you're being accused of giving Hannah, played by Lena Dunham, an STD.
Actually, I'm pretty sure you gave it to me. You're the only person I've been having sex with. It is not prevented by condoms.
Hold your roll. I didn't give it to you.
Well, how do you know?
Because I got tested and I don't have that.
You got tested? When did you get tested?
Last week.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm sure. So now you owe me an apology.
Okay, I'm sorry. Are you angry with me now?
Just annoyed. Yeah.
Will you still have sex with me?
When it's appropriate. Sure.
You have this extremely physical presence on the show, and often you are only partially dressed as well. What was the shirtlessness your idea or Lena's?
No, Lena's.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that.
It was mine. Yeah, I think you should be shirtless all the time.
And do you really not watch the show?
I don't, no.
And why is that?
Well, I mean, lots of reasons. I just forgot what I looked like and was reminded, oh, my God, that's no one should have to go through that. But mostly because I feel like if it was going to continue, if it was going to kind of go on, that, you know, I came from a theater background where you don't get to look at the end result or what is actually being across. Right. You just have to do your homework and then as much as you can and then show up on the day and be open to something being different or not knowing the answer. And I think that in things that I've watched in the past, like one, I would just obsess about them for months and drive myself crazy.
After you saw your work?
Yeah, of things that I wanted to fix and change or do over again. And I you know, obviously you can't. And same thing with the people around me. I just drive them nuts with like asking them questions. That's annoying.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be allow you to like, oh, next time I won't do that.
Oh, totally.
Better the next time.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a good idea. It just kind of seems yeah. to be what I think I have a natural tendency to try to make things perfect or better looking or change it for the sake of changing it, arbitrary changing or making it look better. And the things that I'm interested in watching in film and theater and television are always the imperfect or the ugly part of it. And I just know of myself, especially while we're shooting it, like I have no interest to see like what is coming across.
Is it true that when that role was brought to you, you said, nah, it's TV, TV's evil, I won't do it?
Yeah. Actually, my agent's over there in the booth, and she was the one that was like, you should actually...
And did she fire you? Did she threaten to fire you for turning down a role?
No. She's just, she just doesn't like me in general, I think. But meeting Lena inside, like that was kind of the thing that sealed the deal for me.
On this show, I ask guests a lot about their kind of aha moments as young people, the thing they saw or experienced or read or whatever that made them pursue whatever creative field they're in. I read that the moment you realized you wanted to be an actor wasn't in a theater or watching TV, but during basic training in the Marines?
No, it wasn't basic training. It was in the fleet. Artillery was firing white phosphorus over us. I was a mortarman.
As a training exercise.
Yeah, it was a training. Yeah, and got the coordinates wrong, and they fired on us as opposed to the target. So it was really windy, and coupled with the fact that all of us were running
away from it.
Away from it,
because if it touched you, it would burn you. And
yeah, and that was kind of my first experience with even though I'm young, I could die. And the two things that I wanted to do is I wanted to smoke and be an actor. That didn't have any relation to each other. I never really smoke cigarettes. I want to see what.
Really?
Yeah.
Funny.
I want to see what that is like.
Yeah, I almost got killed. Let me kill myself.
Yeah, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
And then you got injured, right? And didn't stay in the Marines?
No, yeah, I broke my sternum.
And had that not happened and had the Marines worked out, would you have ended up where you are now, do you think?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I didn't want to go. Like being a civilian again and all kind of getting my civilian privileges was like a hard thing to swallow, especially when they're kind of overseas doing their job and I wasn't. Like I was here in New York in acting school. Like that was kind of a really difficult transition, and I would say I still regret not being able to
go through the full enlistment.
Yeah, yeah. With that specific group of people. I mean, like, there's no there's
which
no,
is what it's all about at that.
Yeah, yeah,
point, right?
There's no like you kind of join for whatever reasons, and you know we all kind of had reasons, but as soon as you kind of get in with that group of guys, you kind of forget about the outside. Where I remember very specific moments of being in a chow hall and watching President Bush then being like, oh, our military is in a high state of alarm. And I'm like, really? We're on red alert? You know, I'm here eating eggs right now. And thinking about getting a second helping of potatoes. Like where the outside world seems something completely disconnected. And we wanted to go and do our jobs with this, you know, group of guys. And the idea of not being with them through that is like there's no way to describe.
And where did they deploy to?
They went over – they did a Westpac of Iraq and Afghanistan.
And now that you're an actor and you're on in casts and – Is it hard for you not to feel as cast get together and feel, oh, we're part of this group and like, you don't know what you're talking about. I was in the Marines with this unit that I felt. That was feeling close to people.
I think when I first got out, I had a really strong sense of entitlement about being in the military and like not and adjusting to civilian life and getting really aggressive with civilians about like, what are you like complaining about getting in line for a latte? Like, you know, I don't really think that's – I've been fortunate enough to find acting to be able to find the language to express that. So I feel like I haven't gotten – like I started to calm down a little bit.
And no longer judging civilians?
Well, there's also – right. Well, there's also a strong connection between the military, I think, and theater or acting and just that, you know
– In that band of brothers kind of way?
Yeah, but – yeah, that there's – you know, you're trying to accomplish a mission that's greater than yourself. It's not really about you. You have to know your role within a team. You know, you have to be intimate with people in a short amount of time and the stakes are really high. The pressure is really high. Obviously, life or death circumstances don't really compare to, you know, bad crafty, but still, the sentiment of trying to accomplish something that is not about one specific person and putting your trust within other people and the discipline and the self-maintenance, it all applies.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, Adam Driver, it has been a pleasure watching you the last couple of years and a pleasure meeting you. Thanks.
Oh, likewise. Thanks for having me.
Adam Driver is in Inside Llewyn Davis, which is in theaters now, and the new season of Girls, which he will not see, starts momentarily.
They call me baby.
That's almost it for this hour, but before you go, we've got kind of a stocking stuffer. The great songwriter Tim Minchin, the man behind the Matilda musical, performed an original Christmas song just for us. Take it away, Tim.
I wrote a Christmas song when my daughter was born, and I live in London and I come from Australia, so it's a bit about, you know, being not where you feel like you should be when you have a tiny baby. And Christmas and stuff.
I'm looking forward to Christmas. It's sentimental, I know, but I just really like it. I am hardly religious. I'd rather break bread with Dawkins than Desmond Tutu, to be honest. And yes, I have all of the usual objections to consumerism, to the commercialization of an ancient religion, to the westernization of a dead Palestinian press ganged into selling PlayStations and beer. But I still really like it. I'm looking forward to Christmas, though I'm not expecting a visit from Jesus. I'll be seeing my dad. my brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. I don't go in for ancient wisdom. I don't believe just 'cause ideas are tenacious, it means that they're worthy. I get freaked out by churches. Some of the hymns that they sing have nice chords, but the lyrics are dodgy. And yes, I have all of the usual objections to the miseducation of children who in tax-exempt institutions are taught to externalize blame and to feel ashamed and to judge things as plain right or wrong. But I quite like the songs. Not expecting big presents. The old combination of socks, jocks, and chocolates is just fine by me. 'Cause I'll be seeing my dad, my brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. I'll be seeing my dad, my brother and sisters, my gran and my mum. They'll be drinking white wine in the sun. And you, my baby girl, my jet-lagged infant daughter, you'll be handed round the room like a puppy at a primary school, and you won't understand, but you will learn someday that wherever you are and whatever you face, these are the people who make you feel safe in this world. My sweet blue-eyed girl. If my baby girl, when you're 21 or 31 and Christmas comes around and you find yourself 9,000 miles from home, you'll know whatever comes. Your brothers and sisters and me and your mom will be waiting for you in the sun when Christmas comes. Your brothers and sisters, your aunts and your uncles, your grandparents, cousins, and me and your mom will be waiting for you in the sun, drinking white wine in the sun. Darling, when Christmas comes, we'll be waiting for you in the sun, drinking white wine in the sun, waiting for you in the sun, waiting. I really like Christmas. It's sentimental, I know.
That was Tim Minchin performing White Wine in the Sun for us at a live Studio 360 show at the Green Space in New York. You can see a video of that performance at studio360.org. And now this hour of Studio 360 is done. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoy Christmas, Boxing Day, Kwanzaa, and New Year's. And if you're serious about finally making some creative thing in 2014, take a minute to tell us about your New Year's resolution. And maybe we'll spend 2014 trying to make sure you get it done. Let us know what your plan for the year is at studio360.org. Or call and leave us a message at 646-580-0360. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisvaram,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Julie Dorio,
Zachary McCune,
Felicity Sheehy.
Special thanks to Peter O'Dowd at KJZZ in Phoenix, and regular thanks to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org, and by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works.
Honey, what is it?
It's a one-year membership in the Jelly of the Month Club.
Oh, God.
Clark, it's the gift that keeps on giving the whole year.
That it is, Edward. That it is indeed.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, we look back a century to 1913.
It was the beginning of a century of absolute chaos. As so often, the artists heard it and reflected it first.
In New York and Paris and all over, people were confronted with new art and music that seemed weird, ugly, wrong. Culture Shock 1913, a special edition of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.